whereas the sum of individual wills is never expressed by the activity of a single historic personage. Historical science, in its endeavor to draw nearer to truth, continually takes smaller and smaller units for examination. But however small the units it takes, we feel that to take any unit disconnected from others, or to assume a beginning of any phenomenon, or to say that the will of many men is expressed by the actions of any one historic personage, is in itself false. It needs no critical exertion to reduce utterly to dust any deductions drawn from history. It is merely necessary to select some larger or smaller unit as the subject of observation, as criticism has every right to do, seeing that whatever unit history observes must always be arbitrarily selected. Only by taking infinitesimally small units for observation, the differential of history, that is, the individual tendencies of men, and attaining to the art of integrating them, that is, finding the sum of these infinitesimals, can we hope to arrive at the laws of history. The first 15 years of the 19th century in Europe present an extraordinary movement of millions of people. Men leave their customary pursuits, hasten from one side of Europe to the other, plunder and slaughter one another, triumph, and are plunged in despair. And for some years, the whole course of life is altered and presents an intensive movement which first increases and then slackens. What was the cause of this movement? By what laws was it governed? Asks the mind of man. The historians, replying to this question, lay before us the sayings and doings of a few dozen men in a building in the city of Paris, calling these sayings and doings the Revolution. Then they give a detailed biography of Napoleon and of certain people favorable or hostile to him, tell of the influence some of these people had on others, and say, that is why this movement took place, and those are its laws. But the mind of man not only refuses to believe this explanation, but plainly says that this method of explanation is fallacious, because in it a weaker phenomenon is taken as the cause of a stronger. The sum of human wills produced the Revolution and Napoleon, and only the sum of those wills first tolerated and then destroyed them. But every time there have been conquests, there have been conquerors. Every time there has been a revolution in any state, there have been great men, says history. And indeed, human reason replies, every time conquerors appear, there have been wars, but this does not prove that the conquerors caused the wars, and that it is possible to find the laws of a war in the personal activity of a single man. Whenever I look at my watch, and its hands point to 10, I hear the bells of the neighboring church. But because the bells begin to ring when the hands of the clock reach 10, I have no right to assume that the movement of the bells is caused by the position of the hands of the watch. Whenever I see the movement of a locomotive, I hear the whistle and see the valves opening and wheels turning. But I have no right to conclude that the whistling and the turning of wheels are the cause of the movement of the engine. The peasants say that a cold wind blows in late spring because the oaks are budding. And really, every spring cold winds do blow when the oak is budding. But though I do not know what causes the cold winds to blow when the oak buds unfold, I cannot agree with the peasants that the unfolding of the oak buds is the cause of the cold wind, for the force of the wind is beyond the influence of the buds. I see only a coincidence of occurrences, such as happens with all the phenomena of life. And I see that however much and however carefully I observe the hands of the watch and the valves and wheels of the engine and the oak, I shall not discover the cause of the bells ringing, the engine moving, or of the winds of spring. To do that, I must entirely change my point of view and study the laws of the movement of steam, of the bells, and of the wind. History must do the same, and attempts in this direction have already been made. To study the laws of history, We must completely change the subject of our observation, must leave aside kings, ministers, and generals, and study the common, infinitesimally small elements by which the masses are moved. No one can say in how far it is possible for man to advance in this way toward an understanding of the laws of history, but it is evident that only along that path does the possibility of discovering the laws of history lie, and that, as yet, not a millionth part as much mental effort has been applied in this direction by historians as has been devoted to describing the actions of various kings, commanders, and ministers, and propounding the historian's own reflections concerning these actions. Chapter 2. Summary of campaign before Borodino and explanation of Kutuzov's subsequent movements. The forces of a dozen European nations burst into Russia. The Russian army and people avoided a collision till Smolensk was reached, and again from Smolensk to Borodino. The French army pushed on to Moscow, its goal, its impetus ever increasing as it neared its aim, just as the velocity of a falling body increases as it approaches the earth. Behind it were 700 miles of hunger-stricken, hostile country. Ahead were a few dozen miles separating it from its goal. Every soldier in Napoleon's army felt this, and the invasion moved on by its own momentum. The more the Russian army retreated, the more fiercely a spirit of hatred of the enemy flared up, and while it retreated, the army increased and consolidated. At Borodino, a collision took place. Neither army was broken up, but the Russian army retreated immediately after the collision, as inevitably as a ball recoils after colliding with another having a greater momentum, and with equal inevitability, the ball of invasion that had advanced with such momentum rolled on for some distance, though the collision had deprived it of all its force. The Russians retreated 80 miles to beyond Moscow, and the French reached Moscow and there came to a standstill. For 5 weeks after that, there was not a single battle. The French did not move. As a bleeding, mortally wounded animal licks its wounds, they remained inert in Moscow for 5 weeks. And then suddenly, with no fresh reason, fled back. They made a dash for the Kaluga Road, and after a victory, for at Maloyaroslavets the field of conflict again remained theirs, without undertaking a single serious battle, they fled still more rapidly back to Smolensk, beyond the Berezina, beyond Vilna, and farther still. On the evening of the 26th of August, Kutuzov and the whole Russian army were convinced that the Battle of Borodino was a victory. Kutuzov reported so to the Emperor. He gave orders to prepare for a fresh conflict to finish the enemy, and did this not to deceive anyone, but because he knew that the enemy was beaten, as everyone who had taken part in the battle knew it. But all that evening and next day, reports came in one after another of unheard-of losses, of the loss of half the army, and a fresh battle proved physically impossible. It was impossible to give battle before information had been collected, the wounded gathered in, the supplies of ammunition replenished, the slain reckoned up, new officers appointed to replace those who had been killed, and before the men had had food and sleep. And meanwhile, the very next morning after the battle, the French army advanced of itself upon the Russians, carried forward by the force of its own momentum, now seemingly increased in inverse proportion to the square of the distance from its aim. Kutuzov's wish was to attack next day, and the whole army desired to do so. But to make an attack, the wish to do so is not sufficient. There must also be a possibility of doing it, and that possibility did not exist. It was impossible not to retreat a day's march. And then, in the same way, it was impossible not to retreat another and a third day's march. And at last, on the 1st of September, when the army drew near Moscow, despite the strength of the feeling that had arisen in all ranks, the force of circumstances compelled it to retire beyond Moscow, and the troops retired one more last day's march and abandoned Moscow to the enemy. For people accustomed to think that plans of campaign and battles are made by generals, as any one of us sitting over a map in his study may imagine how he would have arranged things in this or that battle. The questions present themselves. Why did Kutuzov, during the retreat, not do this or that? Why did he not take up a position before reaching Fili? Why did he not retire at once by the Kaluga road, abandoning Moscow, and so on? People accustomed to think in that way forget, or do not know, the inevitable conditions which always limit the activities of any commander-in-chief. The activity of a commander-in-chief does not at all resemble the activity we imagine to ourselves when we sit at ease in our studies, examining some campaign on the map, with a certain number of troops on this and that side in a certain known locality, and begin our plans from some given moment. A commander-in-chief is never dealing with the beginning of any event, the position from which we always contemplate it. The commander-in-chief is always in the midst of a series of shifting events, and so he can never at any moment consider the whole import of an event that is occurring. Moment by moment, the event is imperceptibly shaping itself. And at every moment of this continuous, uninterrupted shaping of events, the commander-in-chief is in the midst of a most complex play of intrigues, worries, contingencies, authorities, projects, counsels, threats, and deceptions, and is continually obliged to reply to innumerable questions addressed to him, which constantly conflict with one another. Learned military authorities quite seriously tell us that Kutuzov should have moved his army to the Kaluga road long before reaching Fili, and that somebody actually submitted such a proposal to him. But a commander-in-chief, especially at a difficult moment, has always before him not one proposal, but dozens simultaneously, and all these proposals, based on strategics and tactics, contradict each other. A commander-in-chief's business, it would seem, is simply to choose one of these projects. But even that he cannot do. Events and time do not wait. For instance, on the 28th, it is suggested to him to cross to the Kaluga road. But just then, an adjutant gallops up from Miloradovich asking whether he is to engage the French or retire. An order must be given him at once, that instant. And the order to retreat carries us past the turn to the Kaluga road. And after the adjutant comes the commissary general, asking where the stores are to be taken. And the chief of the hospitals asks where the wounded are to go. And a courier from Petersburg brings a letter from the sovereign which does not admit of the possibility of abandoning Moscow. And the commander-in-chief's rival, the man who is undermining him, and there are always not merely one but several such, presents a new project diametrically opposed to that of turning to the Kaluga road. And the commander-in-chief himself needs sleep and refreshment to maintain his energy. And a respectable general who has been overlooked in the distribution of rewards comes to complain. And the inhabitants of the district pray to be defended. And an officer sent to inspect the locality comes in and gives a report quite contrary to what was said by the officer previously sent. And a spy, a prisoner, and a general who has been on reconnaissance all describe the position of the enemy's army differently. People accustomed to misunderstand or to forget these inevitable conditions of a commander-in-chief's actions describe to us, for instance, the position of the army at Fili and assume that the commander-in-chief could, on the 1st of September, quite freely decide whether to abandon Moscow or defend it. Whereas, with the Russian army less than 4 miles from Moscow, no such question existed. When had that question been settled? At Drissa and at Smolensk, and most palpably of all, on the 24th of August at Shevardino, and on the 26th at Borodino, and each day and hour and minute of the retreat from Borodino to Fili. Chapter 3. Kutuzov and his generals at the Pokloni Hill, Council of War at Fili. When Yermolov, having been sent by Kutuzov to inspect the position, told the field marshal that it was impossible to fight there before Moscow and that they must retreat, Kutuzov looked at him in silence. "Give me your hand," said he. and turning it over so as to feel the pulse, added, "You're not well, my dear fellow. Think what you're saying." Kutuzov could not yet admit the possibility of retreating beyond Moscow without a battle. On the Pokloni Hill, 4 miles from the Dorogomilov gate of Moscow, Kutuzov got out of his carriage and sat down on a bench by the roadside. A great crowd of generals gathered round him, and Count Rostopchin, who had come out from Moscow, joined them. This brilliant company separated into several groups who all discussed the advantages and disadvantages of the position, the state of the army, the plans suggested, the situation of Moscow, and military questions generally. Though they had not been summoned for the purpose, and though it was not so called, they all felt that this was really a council of war. The conversations all dealt with public questions. If anyone gave or asked for personal news, it was done in a whisper, and they immediately reverted to general matters. No jokes or laughter or smiles even were seen among all these men. They evidently all made an effort to hold themselves at the height the situation demanded. And all these groups, while talking among themselves, tried to keep near the commander-in-chief, whose bench formed the center of the gathering, and to speak so that he might overhear them. The commander-in-chief listened to what was being said and sometimes asked them to repeat their remarks, but did not himself take part in the conversations or express any opinion. After hearing what was being said by one or other of these groups, he generally turned away with an air of disappointment, as though they were not speaking of anything he wished to hear. Some discussed the position that had been chosen, criticizing not the position itself so much as the mental capacity of those who had chosen it. Others argued that a mistake had been made earlier, and that a battle should have been fought 2 days before. Others again spoke of the Battle of Salamanca, which was described by Crozat, a newly arrived Frenchman in a Spanish uniform. This Frenchman and one of the German princes serving with the Russian army were discussing the siege of Saragossa and considering the possibility of defending Moscow in a similar manner. Count Rostopchin was telling a fourth group that he was prepared to die with the city train bands under the walls of the capital, but that he still could not help regretting having been left in ignorance of what was happening, and that had he known it sooner, things would have been different. A fifth group, displaying the profundity of their strategic perceptions, discussed the direction the troops would now have to take. A sixth group was talking absolute nonsense. Kutuzov's expression grew more and more preoccupied and gloomy. From all this talk, he saw only one thing, that to defend Moscow was a physical impossibility in the full meaning of those words. That is to say, so utterly impossible that if any senseless commander were to give orders to fight, confusion would result, but the battle would still not take place. It would not take place because the commanders not merely all recognized the position to be impossible, but in their conversations were only discussing what would happen after its inevitable abandonment. How could the commanders lead their troops to a field of battle they considered it impossible to hold? The lower grade officers, and even the soldiers, who too reason, also considered the position impossible, and therefore could not go to fight, fully convinced as they were of defeat. If Bennigsen insisted on the position being defended, and others still discussed it, the question was no longer important in itself, but only as a pretext for disputes and intrigue. This Kutuzov knew well. Bennigsen, who had chosen the position, warmly displayed his Russian patriotism, Kutuzov could not listen to this without wincing, by insisting that Moscow must be defended. His aim was as clear as daylight to Kutuzov. If the defense failed, to throw the blame on Kutuzov, who had brought the army as far as the Sparrow Hills without giving battle. If it succeeded, to claim the success as his own. Or, if battle were not given, to clear himself of the crime of abandoning Moscow. But this intrigue did not now occupy the old man's mind. One terrible question absorbed him, and to that question he heard no reply from anyone. The question for him now was, have I really allowed Napoleon to reach Moscow? And when did I do so? When was it decided? Can it have been yesterday, when I ordered Platov to retreat? Or was it the evening before, when I had a nap and told Bennigsen to issue orders? Or was it earlier still? When? When was this terrible affair decided? Moscow must be abandoned. The army must retreat, and the order to do so must be given. To give that terrible order seemed to him equivalent to resigning the command of the army. And not only did he love power, to which he was accustomed, the honors awarded to Prince Prozorovsky, under whom he had served in Turkey, galled him, but he was convinced that he was destined to save Russia, and that that was why, against the emperor's wish, and by the will of the people, he had been chosen commander-in-chief. He was convinced that he alone could maintain command of the army in these difficult circumstances, and that in all the world he alone could encounter the invincible Napoleon without fear. And he was horrified at the thought of the order he had to issue. But something had to be decided, and these conversations around him, which were assuming too free a character, must be stopped. He called the most important generals to him. "My head, be it good or bad, must depend on itself," said he, rising from the bench, and he rode to Filí, where his carriages were waiting. The Council of War began to assemble at 2 p.m. in the better and roomier part of Andrew Savostyanov's hut. The men, women, and children of the large peasant family crowded into the back room across the passage. Only Malasha, Andrew's 6-year-old granddaughter, whom His Serene Highness had petted and to whom he had given a lump of sugar while drinking his tea, remained on the top of the brick oven in the larger room. Malasha looked down from the oven with shy delight at the faces, uniforms, and decorations of the generals, who one after another came into the room and sat down on the broad benches in the corner under the icons. Granddad himself, as Malasha in her own mind called Kutuzov, sat apart in a dark corner behind the oven. He sat sunk deep in a folding armchair and continually cleared his throat and pulled at the collar of his coat, which, though it was unbuttoned, still seemed to pinch his neck. Those who entered went up one by one to the field marshal. He pressed the hands of some and nodded to others. His adjutant Kaisarov was about to draw back the curtain of the window facing Kutuzov, but the latter moved his hand angrily, and Kaisarov understood that His Serene Highness did not wish his face to be seen. Round the peasant's deal table, on which lay maps, plans, pencils, and papers, so many people gathered that the orderlies brought in another bench and put it beside the table. Yermolov, Kaisarov, and Toll, who had just arrived, sat down on this bench. In the foremost place, immediately under the icons, sat Barclay de Tolly, his high forehead merging into his bald crown. He had a St. George's cross round his neck and looked pale and ill. He had been feverish for 2 days and was now shivering and in pain. Beside him sat Uvarov, who with rapid gesticulations was giving him some information, speaking in low tones as they all did. Chubby little Dokhturov was listening attentively with eyebrows raised and arms folded on his stomach. On the other side sat Count Ostermann Tolstoy, seemingly absorbed in his own thoughts. His broad head, with its bold features and glittering eyes, was resting on his hand. Raevsky, twitching forward the black hair on his temples, as was his habit, glanced now at Kutuzov and now at the door with a look of impatience. Konovnitsyn's firm, handsome, and kindly face was lit up by a tender, sly smile. His glance met Malasha's, and the expression of his eyes caused the little girl to smile. They were all waiting for Bennigsen, who, on the pretext of inspecting the position, was finishing his savory dinner. They waited for him from 4 till 6 o'clock, and did not begin their deliberations all that time, but talked in low tones of other matters. Only when Bennigsen had entered the hut did Kutuzov leave his corner and draw toward the table, but not near enough for the candles that had been placed there to light up his face. Bennigsen opened the council with the question, "Are we to abandon Russia's ancient and sacred capital without a struggle, or are we to defend it?" A prolonged and general silence followed. There was a frown on every face, and only Kutuzov's angry grunts and occasional cough broke the silence. All eyes were gazing at him. Malasha, too, looked at granddad. She was nearest to him and saw how his face puckered. He seemed about to cry, but this did not last long. "Russia's ancient and sacred capital," he suddenly said, repeating Bennigsen's words in an angry voice and thereby drawing attention to the false note in them. "Allow me to tell you, Your Excellency, that that question has no meaning for a Russian." He lurched his heavy body forward. "Such a question cannot be put. It is senseless. The question I've asked these gentlemen to meet to discuss is a military one. The question is that of saving Russia. Is it better to give up Moscow without a battle, or by accepting battle to risk losing the army as well as Moscow? That is the question on which I want your opinion." And he sank back in his chair. The discussion began. Bennigsen did not yet consider his game lost. Admitting the view of Barclay and others that a defensive battle at Filí was impossible, but imbued with Russian patriotism and the love of Moscow, he proposed to move troops from the right to the left flank during the night and attack the French right flank the following day. Opinions were divided, and arguments were advanced for and against that project. Yermolov, Dokhturov, and Raevsky agreed with Bennigsen. Whether feeling it necessary to make a sacrifice before abandoning the capital, or guided by other personal considerations, these generals seemed not to understand that this council could not alter the inevitable course of events and that Moscow was in effect already abandoned. The other generals, however, understood it, and, leaving aside the question of Moscow, spoke of the direction the army should take in its retreat. Malasha, who kept her eyes fixed on what was going on before her, understood the meaning of the council differently. It seemed to her that it was only a personal struggle between Granddad and Long Coat, as she termed Bennigsen. She saw that they grew spiteful when they spoke to one another, and in her heart she sided with Granddad. In the midst of the conversation, she noticed Granddad give Bennigsen a quick, subtle glance, and then to her joy she saw that Granddad said something to Long Coat which settled him. Bennigsen suddenly reddened and paced angrily up and down the room. What so affected him was Kutuzov's calm and quiet comment on the advantage or disadvantage of Bennigsen's proposal to move troops by night from the right to the left flank to attack the French right wing. "Gentlemen," said Kutuzov, "I cannot approve of the Count's plan. Moving troops in close proximity to an enemy is always dangerous, and military history supports that view. For instance..." Kutuzov seemed to reflect, searching for an example. Then, with a clear, naive look at Bennigsen, he added, "Oh, yes, sir. Take the Battle of Friedland, which I think the Count well remembers, and which was not fully successful, only because our troops were rearranged too near the enemy." There followed a momentary pause, which seemed very long to them all. The discussion recommenced, but pauses frequently occurred, and they all felt that there was no more to be said. During one of these pauses, Kutuzov heaved a deep sigh as if preparing to speak. They all looked at him. "Well, gentlemen, I see that it is I who will have to pay for the broken crockery," said he, and rising slowly, he moved to the table. "Gentlemen, I have heard your views. Some of you will not agree with me. But I..." He paused. "By the authority entrusted to me by my sovereign and country, order a retreat." After that, the generals began to disperse with the solemnity and circumspect silence of people who are leaving after a funeral. Some of the generals, in low tones and in a strain very different from the way they had spoken during the council, communicated something to their commander-in-chief. Malasha, who had long been expected for supper, climbed carefully backwards down from the oven, her bare little feet catching at its projections, and slipping between the legs of the generals, she darted out of the room. When he had dismissed the generals, Kutuzov sat a long time with his elbows on the table, thinking always of the same terrible question. When? When did the abandonment of Moscow become inevitable? When was that done which settled the matter? And who was to blame for it? I did not expect this, said he to his adjutant Schneider when the latter came in late that night. I did not expect this. I did not think this would happen.
You should take some rest, Your Serene Highness, replied Schneider.
No, they shall eat horse flesh yet, like the Turks, exclaimed Kutuzov without replying, striking the table with his podgy fist. They shall too. If only...
Chapter 4. The author's reflections on the abandonment of Moscow. Rostopchin's conduct and that of private individuals. At that very time, in circumstances even more important than retreating without a battle, namely the evacuation and burning of Moscow, Rostopchin, who was usually represented as being the instigator of that event, acted in an altogether different manner from Kutuzov. After the Battle of Borodino, the abandonment and burning of Moscow was as inevitable as the retreat of the army beyond Moscow without fighting. Every Russian might have predicted it, not by reasoning, but by the feeling implanted in each of us and in our fathers. The same thing that took place in Moscow had happened in all the towns and villages on Russian soil, beginning with Smolensk, without the participation of Count Rostopchin and his broadsheets. The people awaited the enemy unconcernedly, did not riot or become excited or tear anyone to pieces, but faced its fate, feeling within it the strength to find what it should do at that most difficult moment. And as soon as the enemy drew near, the wealthy classes went away, abandoning their property, while the poorer remained and burned and destroyed what was left. The consciousness that this would be so and would always be so was and is present in the heart of every Russian. And a consciousness of this, and a foreboding that Moscow would be taken, was present in Russian Moscow society in 1812. Those who had quitted Moscow already in July and at the beginning of August showed that they expected this. Those who went away, taking what they could and abandoning their houses and half their belongings, did so from the latent patriotism which expresses itself not by phrases or by giving one's children to save the fatherland and similar unnatural exploits, but unobtrusively, simply, organically, and therefore in the way that always produces the most powerful results. It is disgraceful to run away from danger. Only cowards are running away from Moscow, they were told. In his broadsheets, Rostopchin impressed on them that to leave Moscow was shameful. They were ashamed to be called cowards, ashamed to leave, but still they left, knowing it had to be done. Why did they go? It is impossible to suppose that Rostopchin had scared them by his accounts of horrors Napoleon had committed in conquered countries. The first people to go away were the rich, educated people who knew quite well that Vienna and Berlin had remained intact, and that during Napoleon's occupation the inhabitants had spent their time pleasantly in the company of the charming Frenchmen, whom the Russians, and especially the Russian ladies, then liked so much. They went away because for Russians there could be no question as to whether things would go well or ill under French rule in Moscow. It was out of the question to be under French rule. It would be the worst thing that could happen. They went away even before the Battle of Borodino, and still more rapidly after it, despite Rostopchin's calls to defend Moscow or the announcement of his intention to take the wonder-working icon of the Iberian Mother of God and go to fight, or of the balloons that were to destroy the French, and despite all the nonsense Rostopchin wrote in his broadsheets. They knew that it was for the army to fight, and that if it could not succeed, it would not do to take young ladies and house serfs to the Three Hills quarter of Moscow to fight Napoleon, and that they must go away, sorry as they were to abandon their property to destruction. They went away without thinking of the tremendous significance of that immense and wealthy city being given over to destruction. For a great city with wooden buildings was certain, when abandoned by its inhabitants, to be burned. They went away, each on his own account, and yet it was only in consequence of their going away that the momentous event was accomplished, that will always remain the greatest glory of the Russian people. The lady who, afraid of being stopped by Count Rostopchin's orders, had already in June moved with her Negroes and her women jesters from Moscow to her Saratov estate, with a vague consciousness that she was not Bonaparte's servant, was really, simply, and truly carrying out the great work which saved Russia. But Count Rostopchin, who now taunted those who left Moscow and now had the government offices removed, now distributed quite useless weapons to the drunken rabble, now had processions displaying the icons, and now forbade Father Augustine to remove icons or the relics of saints, now seized all the private carts in Moscow, and on 136 of them removed the balloon that was being constructed by Lepich, now hinted that he would burn Moscow, and related how he had set fire to his own house, now wrote a proclamation to the French solemnly upbraiding them for having destroyed his orphanage, now claimed the glory of having hinted that he would burn Moscow, and now repudiated the deed, now ordered the people to catch all spies and bring them to him, and now reproached them for doing so, now expelled all the French residents from Moscow, and now allowed Madame Aubert Chalmay, the center of the whole French colony in Moscow, to remain, but ordered the venerable old postmaster Klucharyov to be arrested and exiled for no particular offense, now assembled the people at the Three Hills to fight the French, and now, to get rid of them, handed over to them a man to be killed, and himself drove away by a back gate, now declared that he would not survive the fall of Moscow, and now wrote French verses and albums concerning his share in the affair. This man did not understand the meaning of what was happening, but merely wanted to do something himself that would astonish people, to perform some patriotically heroic feat, and like a child, he made sport of the momentous and unavoidable event, the abandonment and burning of Moscow, and tried with his puny hand now to speed and now to stay the enormous popular tide that bore him along with it. Chapter 5. Hélène in Petersburg. Conversion to Catholicism and plans for remarriage. Hélène, having returned with the court from Vilna to Petersburg, found herself in a difficult position. In Petersburg, she had enjoyed the special protection of a grandee who occupied one of the highest posts in the empire. In Vilna, she had formed an intimacy with a young foreign prince. When she returned to Petersburg, both the magnate and the prince were there, and both claimed their rights. Hélène was faced by a new problem: how to preserve her intimacy with both without offending either. What would have seemed difficult or even impossible to another woman did not cause the least embarrassment to Countess Bezukhova, who evidently deserved her reputation of being a very clever woman. Had she attempted concealment or tried to extricate herself from her awkward position by cunning, she would have spoiled her case by acknowledging herself guilty. But Hélène, like a really great man who can do whatever he pleases, at once assumed her own position to be correct, as she sincerely believed it to be, and that everyone else was to blame. The first time the young foreigner allowed himself to reproach her, she lifted her beautiful head, and half turning to him, said firmly, "That's just like a man, selfish and cruel. I expected nothing else. A woman sacrifices herself for you, she suffers, and this is her reward. What right have you, Monseigneur, to demand an account of my attachments and friendships? He is a man who has been more than a father to me." The prince was about to say something, but Hélène interrupted him. "Well, yes," said she, "it may be that he has other sentiments for me than those of a father, but that is not a reason for me to shut my door on him. I'm not a man that I should repay kindness with ingratitude. Know, Monseigneur, that in all that relates to my intimate feelings, I render account only to God and to my conscience," she concluded, laying her hand on her beautiful, fully expanded bosom, and looking up to heaven. "But for heaven's sake, listen to me. Marry me, and I will be your slave." "But that's impossible. You won't deign to demean yourself by marrying me. You," said Hélène, beginning to cry. The prince tried to comfort her, but Hélène, as if quite distraught, said through her tears that there was nothing to prevent her marrying, that there were precedents, They were up to that time very few, but she mentioned Napoleon and some other exalted personages, that she had never been her husband's wife, and that she had been sacrificed. But the law, religion, said the prince, already yielding. The law, religion, what have they been invented for if they can't arrange that? Said Hélène. The prince was surprised that so simple an idea had not occurred to him, and he applied for advice to the holy brethren of the Society of Jesus, with whom he was on intimate terms. A few days later, at one of those enchanting fêtes which Hélène gave at her country house on the Stone Island, the charming Monsieur de Jobert, a man no longer young, with snow-white hair and brilliant black eyes, a Jesuit à robe courte, a lay member of the Society of Jesus, was presented to her, and in the garden, by the light of the illuminations and to the sound of music, talked to her for a long time of the love of God, of Christ, of the Sacred Heart, and of the consolations the one true Catholic religion affords in this world and the next. Hélène was touched, and more than once tears rose to her eyes and to those of Monsieur de Jobert, and their voices trembled. A dance, for which her partner came to seek her, put an end to her discourse with her future directeur de conscience, but the next evening Monsieur de Jobert came to see Hélène when she was alone, and after that often came again. One day he took the Countess to a Roman Catholic church, where she knelt down before the altar to which she was led. The enchanting middle-aged Frenchman laid his hands on her head, and, as she herself afterward described it, she felt something like a fresh breeze wafted into her soul. It was explained to her that this was la grâce. After that, a long-frocked abbé was brought to her. She confessed to him, and he absolved her from her sins. Next day, she received a box containing the sacred host, which was left at her house for her to partake of. A few days later, Hélène learned with pleasure that she had now been admitted to the true Catholic Church, and that in a few days the Pope himself would hear of her and would send her a certain document. All that was done around her and to her at this time, all the attention devoted to her by so many clever men and expressed in such pleasant, refined ways, and the state of dove-like purity she was now in, she wore only white dresses and white ribbons all that time, gave her pleasure, but her pleasure did not cause her for a moment to forget her aim. And as it always happens in contests of cunning that a stupid person gets the better of cleverer ones, Hélène, having realized that the main object of all these words and all this trouble was, after converting her to Catholicism, to obtain money from her for Jesuit institutions, as to which she received indications, before parting with her money, insisted that the various operations necessary to free her from her husband should be performed. In her view, the aim of every religion was merely to preserve certain proprieties while affording satisfaction to human desires. And with this aim, in one of her talks with her father confessor, she insisted on an answer to the question, in how far was she bound by her marriage? They were sitting in the twilight by a window in the drawing room. The scent of flowers came in at the window. Hélène was wearing a white dress, transparent over her shoulders and bosom. The abbé, a well-fed man with a plump, clean-shaven chin, a pleasant, firm mouth, and white hands meekly folded on his knees, sat close to Hélène, and with a subtle smile on his lips and a peaceful look of delight at her beauty, occasionally glanced at her face as he explained his opinion on the subject. Hélène, with an uneasy smile, looked at his curly hair and his plump, clean-shaven, blackish cheeks, and every moment expected the conversation to take a fresh turn. But the abbé, though he evidently enjoyed the beauty of his companion, was absorbed in his mastery of the matter. The course of the father confessor's arguments ran as follows. Ignorant of the import of what you were undertaking, you made a vow of conjugal fidelity to a man who, on his part, by entering the married state without faith in the religious significance of marriage, committed an act of sacrilege. That marriage lacked the dual significance it should have had. Yet, in spite of this, your vow was binding. You swerved from it. What did you commit by so acting? A venial or a mortal sin? a venial sin, for you acted without evil intention. If now you married again with the object of bearing children, your sin might be forgiven. But the question is again a twofold one. Firstly, but suddenly Hélène, who was getting bored, said with one of her bewitching smiles, "But I think that having espoused the true religion, I cannot be bound by what a false religion laid upon me." The director of her conscience was astounded at having the case presented to him thus, with the simplicity of Columbus's egg. He was delighted at the unexpected rapidity of his pupil's progress, but could not abandon the edifice of argument he had laboriously constructed. "Let us understand one another, Countess," said he with a smile, and began refuting his spiritual daughter's arguments. Hélène understood that the question was very simple and easy from the ecclesiastical point of view, and that her directors were making difficulties only because they were apprehensive as to how the matter would be regarded by the secular authorities. So she decided that it was necessary to prepare the opinion of society. She provoked the jealousy of the elderly magnate and told him what she had told her other suitor. That is, she put the matter so that the only way for him to obtain a right over her was to marry her. The elderly magnate was at first as much taken aback by this suggestion of marriage with a woman whose husband was alive as the younger man had been. But Hélène's imperturbable conviction that it was as simple and natural as marrying a maiden had its effect on him too. Had Hélène herself shown the least sign of hesitation, shame, or secrecy, her cause would certainly have been lost. But not only did she show no signs of secrecy or shame, on the contrary, with good-natured naivete, she told her intimate friends, and these were all Petersburg, that both the prince and the magnate had proposed to her, and that she loved both and was afraid of grieving either. A rumor immediately spread in Petersburg, not that Hélène wanted to be divorced from her husband. Had such a report spread, many would have opposed so illegal an intention, but simply that the unfortunate and interesting Hélène was in doubt which of the two men she should marry. The question was no longer whether this was possible, but only which was the better match, and how the matter would be regarded at court. There were, it is true, some rigid individuals unable to rise to the height of such a question, who saw in the project a desecration of the sacrament of marriage. But there were not many such, and they remained silent, while the majority were interested in Hélène's good fortune and in the question which match would be the more advantageous. Whether it was right or wrong to remarry while one had a husband living, they did not discuss, for that question had evidently been settled by people wiser than you or me, as they said, and to doubt the correctness of that decision would be to risk exposing one's stupidity and incapacity to live in society. Only Marya Dmitrievna Akhrosimova, who had come to Petersburg that summer to see one of her sons, allowed herself plainly to express an opinion contrary to the general one. Meeting Hélène at a ball, she stopped her in the middle of the room, and amid general silence said in her gruff voice, "So wives of living men have started marrying again. Perhaps you think you've invented a novelty? You've been forestalled, my dear. It was thought of long ago. It is done in all the brothels." And with these words, Marya Dmitrievna, turning up her wide sleeves with her usual threatening gesture and glancing sternly round, moved across the room. Though people were afraid of Marya Dmitrievna, she was regarded in Petersburg as a buffoon, and so of what she had said they only noticed and repeated in a whisper the one coarse word she had used, supposing the whole sting of her remark to lie in that word. Prince Vasily, who of late very often forgot what he had said and repeated one and the same thing 100 times, remarked to his daughter whenever he chanced to see her, "Hélène, I have a word to say with you," and he would lead her aside, drawing her hand downward. "I've heard of certain projects concerning, you know. Well, my dear child, you know how your father's heart rejoices to know that you've suffered so much. But, my dear child, consult only your own heart. That is all I have to say." And concealing his unvarying emotion, he would press his cheek against his daughter's and move away. Bilibin, who had not lost his reputation of an exceedingly clever man, and who was one of the disinterested friends so brilliant a woman as Hélène always has, men friends who can never change into lovers, once gave her his view of the matter at a small and intimate gathering. "Listen, believing," said Hélène. She always called friends of that sort by their surnames, and she touched his coat sleeve with her white, beringed fingers. "Tell me, as you would a sister, what I ought to do. Which of the two?" Bilibin wrinkled up the skin over his eyebrows and pondered, with a smile on his lips. "You're not taking me unawares, you know," said he. "As a true friend, I've thought and thought again about your affair. You see, if you marry the prince," he meant the younger man, and he crooked one finger, "you forever lose the chance of marrying the other, and you will displease the court besides. You know, there is some kind of connection. But if you marry the old count, you will make his last days happy, and as widow of the grand... the prince would no longer be making a mésalliance by marrying you." And Bilibin smoothed out his forehead. "That's a true friend," said Hélène, beaming, and again touching Bilibin's sleeve. "But I love them, you know, and don't want to distress either of them. I would give my life for the happiness of them both." Bilibin shrugged his shoulders, as much as to say that not even he could help in that difficulty. "Une maîtresse femme, a clever woman. That's what is called putting things squarely. She would like to be married to all three at the same time," thought he. "But tell me, how will your husband look at the matter?" Bilibin asked, his reputation being so well established that he did not fear to ask so naive a question. "Will he agree?" "Oh, he loves me so," said Hélène, who for some reason imagined that Pierre too loved her. "He will do anything for me." Bilibin puckered his skin in preparation for something witty. "Even divorce you?" said he. Hélène laughed. Among those who ventured to doubt the justifiability of the proposed marriage was Hélène's mother, Princess Kurágina. She was continually tormented by jealousy of her daughter, and now that jealousy concerned a subject near to her own heart. She could not reconcile herself to the idea. She consulted a Russian priest as to the possibility of divorce and remarriage during her husband's lifetime, and the priest told her that it was impossible, and to her delight showed her a text in the gospel which, as it seemed to him, plainly forbids remarriage while the husband is alive. Armed with these arguments, which appeared to her unanswerable, she drove to her daughter's early one morning so as to find her alone. Having listened to her mother's objections, Hélène smiled blandly and ironically. "But it says plainly, 'Whosoever shall marry her that is divorced,'" said the old princess. "Ah, maman, ne dites pas de bêtises. Vous ne comprenez rien. Dans ma position, j'ai des devoirs." "Oh, mamma, don't talk nonsense. You don't understand anything. In my position, I have obligations," said Hélène, changing from Russian, in which language she always felt that her case did not sound quite clear, into French, which suited it better. "But, my dear, oh, mamma, how is it you don't understand that the Holy Father, who has the right to grant dispensations..." Just then, the lady companion who lived with Hélène came in to announce that His Highness was in the ballroom and wished to see her. "Non. Dites-lui que je ne veux pas le voir, que je suis furieuse contre lui parce qu'il m'a manqué parole." "No, tell him I don't wish to see him. I'm furious with him for not keeping his word to me."
"Comtesse, à tout péché, miséricorde."
"Countess, there is mercy for every sin," said a fair-haired young man with a long face and nose as he entered the room. The old princess rose respectfully and curtsied. The young man who had entered took no notice of her. The princess nodded to her daughter and sidled out of the room. "Yes, she is right," thought the old princess, all her convictions dissipated by the appearance of His Highness. "She is right. But how is it that we, in our irrecoverable youth, did not know it?" "Yet it is so simple," she thought, as she got into her carriage. By the beginning of August, Hélène's affairs were clearly defined, and she wrote a letter to her husband, who, as she imagined, loved her very much, informing him of her intention to marry N.N., and of her having embraced the one true faith, and asking him to carry out all the formalities necessary for a divorce, which would be explained to him by the bearer of the letter. "And so I pray God to have you, my friend, in his holy and powerful keeping. Your friend, Hélène." This letter was brought to Pierre's house when he was on the field of Borodino. Chapter 6. Pierre walks to Mozhaisk, his night lodging there, his dream, and his return to Moscow. Toward the end of the Battle of Borodino, Pierre, having run down from Raevsky's battery a second time, made his way through a gully to Knyazkovo with a crowd of soldiers, reached the dressing station, and seeing blood and hearing cries and groans, hurried on, still entangled in the crowds of soldiers. The one thing he now desired with his whole soul was to get away quickly from the terrible sensations amid which he had lived that day, and return to ordinary conditions of life and sleep quietly in a room in his own bed. He felt that only in the ordinary conditions of life would he be able to understand himself and all he had seen and felt. But such ordinary conditions of life were nowhere to be found. Though shells and bullets did not whistle over the road along which he was going, still on all sides there was what there had been on the field of battle. There was still the same suffering, exhausted, and sometimes strangely indifferent faces, the same blood, the same soldiers' overcoats, the same sounds of firing, which, though distant now, still aroused terror, and besides this, there were the foul air and the dust. Having gone a couple of miles along the Mozhaisk road, Pierre sat down by the roadside. Dusk had fallen, and the roar of guns died away. Pierre lay leaning on his elbow for a long time, gazing at the shadows that moved past him in the darkness. He was continually imagining that a cannonball was flying toward him with a terrific whiz, and then he shuddered and sat up. He had no idea how long he had been there. In the middle of the night, three soldiers, having brought some firewood, settled down near him and began lighting a fire. The soldiers, who threw sidelong glances at Pierre, got the fire to burn and placed an iron pot on it, into which they broke some dried bread and put a little dripping. The pleasant odor of greasy viands mingled with the smell of smoke. Pierre sat up and sighed. The three soldiers were eating and talking among themselves, taking no notice of him. "And who may you be?" one of them suddenly asked Pierre, evidently meaning what Pierre himself had in mind, namely, "If you want to eat, we'll give you some food, only let us know whether you're an honest man." Said Pierre, feeling it necessary to minimize his social position as much as possible, so as to be nearer to the soldiers and better understood by them. "By rights, I'm a militia officer, but my men are not here. I came to the battle and have lost them."
"Oh, there now," said one of the soldiers. Another shook his head.
"Would you like a little mash?" the first soldier asked, and handed Pierre a wooden spoon after licking it clean.
Pierre sat down by the fire and began eating the mash, as they called the food in the cauldron, and he thought it more delicious than any food he had ever tasted. As he sat bending greedily over it, helping himself to large spoonfuls and chewing one after another, his face was lit up by the fire, and the soldiers looked at him in silence.
"Where have you to go to? Tell us," said one of them.
"To Mozhaisk."
"You're a gentleman, aren't you?"
"Yes."
"What's your name?"
"Peter Kirillich."
"Well then, Peter Kirillich, come along with us. We'll take you there."
In the total darkness, the soldiers walked with Pierre to Mozhaisk. By the time they got near Mozhaisk and began ascending the steep hill into the town, the cocks were already crowing. Pierre went on with the soldiers, quite forgetting that his inn was at the bottom of the hill and that he'd already passed it. He would not soon have remembered this, such was his state of forgetfulness, had he not halfway up the hill stumbled upon his groom, who had been to look for him in the town and was returning to the inn. The groom recognized Pierre in the darkness by his white hat.
"Your Excellency," he said, "why, we were beginning to despair. How is it you're on foot, and where are you going, please?"
"Oh, yes," said Pierre.
The soldiers stopped.
"So you found your folk," said one of them. "Well, goodbye, Peter Kirillich, isn't it?" "Goodbye, Peter Kirillich," Pierre heard the other voices repeat.
"Goodbye," he said, and turned with his groom toward the inn. "I ought to give them something," he thought, and felt in his pocket. "No, better not," said another inner voice. There was not a room to be had at the inn. They were all occupied. Pierre went out into the yard, and covering himself up, head and all, lay down in his carriage. Scarcely had Pierre laid his head on the pillow before he felt himself falling asleep. But suddenly, almost with the distinctness of reality, he heard the boom, boom, boom of firing, the thud of projectiles, groans and cries, and smelled blood and powder, and a feeling of horror and dread of death seized him. Filled with fright, he opened his eyes and lifted his head from under his cloak. All was tranquil in the yard. Only someone's orderly passed through the gateway, splashing through the mud, and talked to the innkeeper. Above Pierre's head, some pigeons, disturbed by the movement he had made in sitting up, fluttered under the dark roof of the penthouse. The whole courtyard was permeated by a strong, peaceful smell of stable yards, delightful to Pierre at that moment. He could see the clear, starry sky between the dark roofs of two penthouses. "Thank God there is no more of that," he thought, covering up his head again. "Oh, what a terrible thing is fear, and how shamefully I yielded to it. But they were steady and calm all the time, to the end," thought he. They, in Pierre's mind, were the soldiers, those who had been at the battery, those who had given him food, and those who had prayed before the icon. They, those strange men he had not previously known, stood out clearly and sharply from everyone else. "To be a soldier, just a soldier," thought Pierre as he fell asleep, "to enter communal life completely, to be imbued by what makes them what they are. But how cast off all the superfluous, devilish burden of my outer man? There was a time when I could have done it. I could have run away from my father as I wanted to, or I might have been sent to serve as a soldier after the duel with Dolokhov." And the memory of the dinner at the English Club when he had challenged Dolokhov flashed through Pierre's mind. And then he remembered his benefactor at Torzhok. And now a picture of a solemn meeting of the lodge presented itself to his mind. It was taking place at the English Club, and someone near and dear to him sat at the end of the table. "Yes, that is he. It is my benefactor." "But he died," thought Pierre. "Yes, he died, and I did not know he was alive. How sorry I am that he died, and how glad I am that he is alive again." On one side of the table sat Anatole, Dolokhov, Nesvitsky, Denisov, and others like them. In his dream, the category to which these men belonged was as clearly defined in his mind as the category of those he termed they. And he heard those people, Anatole and Dolokhov, shouting and singing loudly. Yet through their shouting, the voice of his benefactor was heard speaking all the time, and the sound of his words was as weighty and uninterrupted as the booming on the battlefield, but pleasant and comforting. Pierre did not understand what his benefactor was saying, but he knew, the categories of thoughts were also quite distinct in his dream, that he was talking of goodness and the possibility of being what they were. And they, with their simple, kind, firm faces, surrounded his benefactor on all sides. But though they were kindly, they did not look at Pierre and did not know him. Wishing to speak and to attract their attention, he got up, but at that moment his legs grew cold and bare. He felt ashamed, and with one arm covered his legs, from which his cloak had in fact slipped. For a moment, as he was rearranging his cloak, Pierre opened his eyes and saw the same penthouse roofs, posts, and yard, but now they were all bluish, lit up and glittering with frost or dew. "It is dawn," thought Pierre. "But that's not what I want. I want to hear and understand my benefactor's words." Again he covered himself up with his cloak, but now neither the lodge nor his benefactor was there. There were only thoughts clearly expressed in words, thoughts that someone was uttering, or that he himself was formulating. Afterwards, when he recalled those thoughts, Pierre was convinced that someone outside himself had spoken them, though the impressions of that day had evoked them. He had never, it seemed to him, been able to think and express his thoughts like that when awake. To endure war is the most difficult subordination of man's freedom to the law of God, the voice had said. Simplicity is submission to the will of God.
You cannot escape from him. And they are simple. They do not talk, but act. The spoken word is silver, but the unspoken is golden. Man can be master of nothing while he fears death, but he who does not fear possesses all. If there were no suffering, man would not know his limitations, would not know himself. The hardest thing, Pierre went on thinking or hearing in his dream, is to be able in your soul to unite the meaning of all. To unite all? He asked himself. No, not to unite. Thoughts cannot be united, but to harness all these thoughts together is what we need. Yes, one must harness them, he repeated to himself with inward rapture, feeling that these words and they alone expressed what he wanted to say and solved the question that tormented him. Yes, one must harness. It is time to harness.
Time to harness. Time to harness, Your Excellency.
Your Excellency, some voice was repeating. We must harness. It is time to harness. It was the voice of the groom trying to wake him. The sun shone straight into Pierre's face. He glanced at the dirty inn-yard in the middle of which soldiers were watering their lean horses at the pump while carts were passing out of the gate. Pierre turned away with repugnance and, closing his eyes, quickly fell back on the carriage seat. No, I don't want that. I don't want to see and understand that. I want to understand what was revealing itself to me in my dream. One second more and I should have understood it all. But what am I to do? Harness. But how can I harness everything? And Pierre felt with horror that the meaning of all he had seen and thought in the dream had been destroyed. The groom, the coachman, and the innkeeper told Pierre that an officer had come with news that the French were already near Mozhaisk and that our men were leaving it. Pierre got up and, having told them to harness and overtake him, went on foot through the town. The troops were moving on, leaving about 10,000 wounded behind them. There were wounded in the yards, at the windows of the houses, and the streets were crowded with them. In the streets, around carts that were to take some of the wounded away, shouts, curses, and blows could be heard. Pierre offered the use of his carriage, which had overtaken him, to a wounded general he knew, and drove with him to Moscow. On the way, Pierre was told of the death of his brother-in-law, Anatole, and of that of Prince Andrew. Chapter 7. Pierre at Rostopchin's. The affair of Klucharyov and Vereshchagin. Pierre leaves home secretly. On the 30th of August, Pierre reached Moscow. Close to the gates of the city, he was met by Count Rostopchin's adjutant. We've been looking for you everywhere, said the adjutant. The Count wants to see you particularly. He asks you to come to him at once on a very important matter. Without going home, Pierre took a cab and drove to see the Moscow commander-in-chief. Count Rostopchin had only that morning returned to town from his summer villa at Sokolniki. The anteroom and reception room of his house were full of officials who had been summoned or had come for orders. Vasilchikov and Platov had already seen the Count and explained to him that it was impossible to defend Moscow and that it would have to be surrendered. Though this news was being concealed from the inhabitants, the officials, the heads of the various government departments, knew that Moscow would soon be in the enemy's hands, just as Count Rostopchin himself knew it, and to escape personal responsibility, they had all come to the governor to ask how they were to deal with their various departments. As Pierre was entering the reception room, a courier from the army came out of Rostopchin's private room. In answer to questions with which he was greeted, the courier made a despairing gesture with his hand and passed through the room. While waiting in the reception room, Pierre, with weary eyes, watched the various officials, old and young, military and civilian, who were there. They all seemed dissatisfied and uneasy. Pierre went up to a group of men, one of whom he knew. After greeting Pierre, they continued their conversation. If they're sent out and brought back again later on, it will do no harm, but as things are now, one can't answer for anything.
But you see what he writes, said another, pointing to a printed sheet he held in his hand.
Well, that's another matter. That's necessary for the people, said the first.
What is it? Asked Pierre.
Oh, it's a fresh broadsheet.
Pierre took it and began reading. His Serene Highness, Kutuzov, has passed through Mozhaisk in order to join up with the troops moving toward him, and has taken up a strong position where the enemy will not soon attack him. 48 guns with ammunition have been sent him from here, and His Serene Highness says he will defend Moscow to the last drop of blood, and is even ready to fight in the streets. Do not be upset, brothers, that the law courts are closed. Things have to be put in order, and we will deal with villains in our own way. When the time comes, I shall want both town and peasant lads, and will raise a cry a day or two beforehand. But they are not wanted yet, so I hold my peace. An axe will be useful, a hunting spear not bad, but a three-pronged fork will be best of all. A Frenchman is no heavier than a sheaf of rye. Tomorrow after dinner I shall take the Iberian icon of the Mother of God to the wounded in the Catherine Hospital, where we will have some water blessed. That will help them to get well quicker. I too am well now. One of my eyes was sore, but now I am on the lookout with both.
But military men have told me that it is impossible to fight in the town, said Pierre, and that the position...
Well, of course, that's what we were saying, replied the first speaker.
And what does he mean by... One of my eyes was sore, but now I'm on the lookout with both, asked Pierre.
The Count had a sty, replied the adjutant, smiling, and was very much upset when I told him people had come to ask what was the matter with him. By the by, Count, he added suddenly, addressing Pierre with a smile, we heard that you have family troubles, and that the Countess, your wife...
I've heard nothing, Pierre replied unconcernedly.
But what have you heard?
Oh, well, you know, people often invent things. I only say what I heard.
But what did you hear?
Well, they say, continued the adjutant with the same smile, that the Countess, your wife, is preparing to go abroad. I expect it's nonsense.
Possibly, remarked Pierre, looking about him absent-mindedly.
And who is that? He asked, indicating a short old man in a clean blue peasant overcoat with a big snow-white beard and eyebrows and a ruddy face.